So today I want to talk about black holes and thermodynamics. So I'm going to start off by just looking at black holes as a classical solution and sort of discussing a little bit about some of the classical properties and showing how just using a very simple relation of the black hole horizon area, you get to something that looks like a thermodynamic relation. And then I'll sort of take that, that's sort of a very heuristic derivation, but it was really what put people on the trail of black hole thermodynamics in the first place. And then we'll use this Gibbons-Hawking term and look at actually an action principle which derives the properties or the various different thermodynamical quantities for black holes. So we're going to use a sort of cheats method here, if you like, of deriving thermodynamics, in the sense that we're going to use a Euclidean partition function approach. And the really amazing thing is that although this, strictly speaking, isn't well defined, you know, we don't really have a theory of quantum gravity. The Euclidean action is not bounded below. And so this really shouldn't be a sensible thing to do. And yet, if we kind of hold our breaths and tiptoe across the tightrope, we actually get to the other side and get sensible answers. And so this is why when people look at black holes or want to compute, for example, the temperature, we do it essentially by Euclideanization. So even though in many ways it oughtn't to work, it does, and it gives sensible answers, and as long as you're careful. And that's kind of why we do it. So that's the aim of the game today. And then if there's time at the end, I'll sort of highlight just a few sort of puzzles and questions about this sort of marrying of black holes and thermodynamics. So if I look at solutions, exact solutions of Einstein gravity, either in vacuum or possibly charged black holes, there's actually very few. So this is puzzle number one, if you like. So black holes are actually rather simple in Einstein gravity. We can write down a full family of black hole solutions with very few parameters. So David insisted that I wrote down the Kerr solution. So here we go. I'll just write it down in two slightly different formats. Okay, so this is the Kerr solution, and it represents a rotating black hole. So you can see a sort of black hole structure in the sense that you have this mass term, GM, rather like the Schwarzschild solution. But what you've done is you've modified your Schwarzschild geometry by sort of mixing the T and phi coordinates. So if you think about that, if something is rotating around an axis, then that means that its phi angle is actually changing in time. And so the notion of having this off-diagonal term in the metric as sort of twisting in the phi t part is quite reasonable if you think about rotation around an axis. So around an axis, you're going to have a killing vector, a sort of angular killing vector. And indeed, you see this metric doesn't explicitly depend on phi. You also see that d by dt is a killing vector because there's no explicit dependence on time. But that doesn't mean it's static because, of course, if you reverse time, you don't get the same metric. You have to simultaneously reverse t in the sine of a. So that's also kind of obvious. If you're rotating one direction, reverse your clock. It's going to be the other way around. Now, the Kerr solution, it's not so obvious from the first form of writing it down, but having written it in a sort of quasi-orthonormal basis, so the second line, you could see how to construct an orthonormal basis for this metric. You can see that a horizon here is going to be identified when this delta function goes to zero. So if there was no rotation, it would be r equals 2gm. Adding in rotation shifts this horizon just a little bit. But notice that there are very few charges. So here we've got M and A, if you like, or J. And then we would also have Q if charged. So delta would become would have a Q squared term. I think it's plus, isn't it? Not minus. So this black hole doesn't have very many charges. So I'm just saying it's an exact solution of Einstein's equations, possibly with some electromagnetic field. And we can write it down in terms of three numbers, potentially. So it's quite simple, I think, relatively speaking. So the area of our black hole well, we're going to get the area by looking at the event horizon and looking at the area of the two-sphere at that particular radial value. And you can see if you restrict to the sort of theta phi part of the metric, I think I've missed a piece on the first term. I think there should be a minus. You see that instead of 4 pi r squared, you've got 4 pi times r squared plus a squared for the area of the event horizon. And so this r plus is simply given by, you did the Riesen and Nordstrom, and you saw that in that case, the event horizon shifted when there was a charge on the black hole. And here you can see the shift due to the charge and the shift due to this angular momentum. So now I want to imagine that I take one of these black holes and I throw something into it.
How do we interpret the minus horizon?
So that would be an inner horizon. So if you have a solution, like with Risen and Nordstrom, where there were two zeros of in the case of Risen and Nordstrom, it was zeros of GTT, then you've got your event horizon for your external space-time, and that's the one that counts. But then there's also an internal horizon to the black hole. Now, although in the exact solution, the pure black hole, or in that pure Risen and Nordstrom solution, you can analytically extend beyond the inner horizon and go into the region R less than R minus, what you find is if you look from the perspective of just the full space-time and imagining you haven't got this very empty universe where there's just the Risen and Nordstrom black hole, and you perturb the solution by maybe throwing a little matter into it, what you see is that matter kind of blue shifts on this inner horizon, and you develop a sort of mild singularity. So typically, we're not too sure that we really, I mean, although the exact solutions have these inner horizons, I'm not sure that, you know, we kind of worry about them from our perspective as totally external observers. So they're there in the exact solution, but it's not clear if they're actually sort of a physical, you know, have physical meaning. So if we were to sort of go off in a rocket, would we really pass that inner horizon? So now I want to think about what happens if I throw something into the black hole. So I'm imagining I'm going to throw something into the black hole, possibly charged, and I'm going to look at what happens. So I would imagine that as something goes through the event horizon, I'm going to have some sort of dynamics to my solution, so it'll probably chuck out some gravitational radiation, but the black hole will quickly settle down into a new state, with a different mass, possibly different angular momentum, and possibly different charge. So that's the setup I'm going to look at. So let me look at what happens to the area of the event horizon. So the area is going to change, because the location of the event horizon will change and the angular momentum parameter is going to change. So if I look at the change in R plus, then R plus depends on M, A, and Q. So I'm going to have the first term is just going to be simply delta M. So I can see what my change in R plus is. And then I've got to think about what's my change in the area, sorry, in the parameter A, so A and Lord area. I'll just collect this lot together. So if I look at my delta M pieces, I can see that I've got R plus, if I pull them over a common denominator, I've got an r plus squared over r plus minus gm. So I've got that factor. Then I can see I've got two a delta a pieces. And so they combine. So now I have to think, what's my delta A? Well, A was J over M. So I can write the change in my A parameter as a change in J and a change in the mass. And so now I can sort of pull all these pieces together. So then if I look at my A delta A, here I've got the delta J on M, so that's going to give me a minus G A delta J. And then my second piece I can just rewrite again as A delta M on M. So I see that I've got, multiplying delta m, a factor of r plus squared plus a squared, which is really just like an area term. So I'm going to rearrange this into an expression for the change in mass of the black hole. So I've redefined the multiplicative factors in front of delta Q and delta J. So omega here is just the angular velocity of the horizon. And so we see that if there's a shift in angular momentum, then the change in mass goes like the angular velocity times the shift in angular momentum. Then this q on r plus squared plus a squared is just the electrostatic potential of the horizon. And again, there's a shift in delta m if I change my charge. So those both have direct sort of physical interpretations, but here, this first term has the appearance of the temperature times delta of entropy. So what we've got here is something that looks like a thermodynamic relation. And the charge and angular momentum parts are sort of relatively straightforward, but it's this first piece that's kind of interesting. So we looked at the Euclidean Schwarzschild solution, and I argued that the temperature of Schwarzschild was 1 over 8 pi gm. And if I look here and think about what happens to this term here and set A to 0, imagine I'm looking at a Schwarzschild black hole. Well, R plus is 2 gm, so the top line is gm. If I look at the bottom line, I've got 2 pi, and then my R plus squared, which is 4 g squared m squared. So therefore, I get 8 pi gm. So this is what I argued the temperature was for the Schwarzschild black hole. So here, that suggests this is just the generalized expression for the temperature of one of these Kerr-Newman black holes, if I have a charge on it. So what that means is that this additional term, delta A on 4 or 4G, should be identified with a change in entropy. Yeah?
For example, in the case of the tutorial for the Reisner-Nordström mm-hmm. black hole, it appears that when the black hole is extremal, the temperature is zero. Mm-hmm. But in here, if it's it happens the same?
Yeah, because an extremal black hole, so usually you identify an extremal black hole by saying these inner and outer horizons meet. So you've kind of got a repeated route. So you're sort of... And so in that, if you forget about the charge here and just think about the pure Kerr, then the extremal limit is A equals GM. And then your R plus is indeed GM. So you have that same sort of, the horizon is just about to disappear. So, you know, it's sort of, its tension's gone to zero, so to speak.
You're like comparing with the first law of thermodynamics. In this case, it's kind of like the internal energy is the mass.
Yeah, so it's, at the moment, this obviously this is just a sort of an analogy. I mean, in terms of how the story went in developing a notion of black holes and thermodynamics, it was realized that actually, you can derive this relation, but it's just formal. It's just a sort of, oh, yes, that's interesting. It looks like dot, 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 right? But as you start to dig more, you see that black holes have various properties. For example, if you have a positive, if you throw in matter that satisfies a condition that says its energy is positive, so it's just saying T naught naught is positive, then you see that the area always increases. Now, physically, we kind of expect most sensible matter to have positive energy. And so we're saying that in a physical process, classically, the black hole will always increase its, either maintain its area or increase it. And so that sort of corresponds with this notion of entropy generically increasing. So although this starts off as a curiosity, the more you poke at it, the more it seems to sort of stand up as a correspondence. And so then, you know, the question is, how do you make that correspondence firmer? And so the method I'm going to choose, or to at least discuss, is this Euclidean analysis. So at the moment, I'm not saying this proves anything at all, okay? It's just a, hey, look, you know, this is interesting. Perhaps something deeper lies behind it, okay? So let's actually look to see if we can make this a bit more robust. So what we're really going to do here is we're going to embed our classical solutions, our classical gravitational solutions, into a sort of quantum arena, but we're not really going to do anything quantum mechanical. We're just going to be looking at classical solutions, but from a slightly different angle and seeing if the whole picture ties together. And so we're going to try and construct a partition function for our theory of gravity. So typically, we would be taking a trace of states where we would have something, our beta again is 1 over t. I've said that the Boltzmann constant is just going to be set to 1. And h would normally be the Hamiltonian. And so here, this is sort of not in gravity at the moment. I'm just arguing towards an expression that I'm going to use. So I'm looking at an integral of a Hamiltonian density. So first of all, you'd integrate the Hamiltonian density across space, and then I just can introduce that as a sort of integral over time at the price of a factor of 1 over beta. And so this is looking like, I'm going to say this is like 1 over beta times the Euclidean action. So yesterday I was putting this root g instead of root h in the boundary integral, and I think it caused some confusion. And I was just doing it to try and tie into the expression I'd written previously. So I don't think it was a good idea, so I'm going to put root h there. So all I've done is I've said that my e to the minus beta h is going to be equivalent to e to the minus Euclidean action. And we're going to look at computing our Euclidean action for our classical solutions. So typically, we'd expect this sum to be dominated by saddle points, and these saddle points are solutions to the classical equations of motion. So we imagine that our contribution is going to be dominated by classical solutions with periodicity beta. That would be the idea. And so we look at what are these classical solutions and what is their action. So here is where we hit this sort of puzzle, if you like, or one of the things that would have been a problem had we not corrected the Einstein-Hilbert action. Our classical solutions in gravity have zero Ricci curvature, at least for vacuum Einstein gravity. And so that means their action, notionally or naively, is zero. So I mentioned this, I think, at the time, that wasn't it bizarre that you have a whole family of solutions, all of which have the same action. However, we have gone back to our Einstein-Hilbert action and have corrected it by adding this boundary term, the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So now at least we have a chance of finding solutions which may all be Ricci flat, but nonetheless have a different overall gravitational action. So here, our Euclidean action is going to be the boundary term, or a boundary term. So that can be the only contribution. So what's the boundary? Let's just look simply at Schwarzschild, because that's a sort of nice, you know, it'll capture everything that we want to see, and yet it's still relatively simple. So this is our Euclidean Schwarzschild metric. And I argued that as you went to r equal to gm, it's like going to the origin in polar coordinates, provided you identify the tau coordinate with periodicity 8 pi gm. So that was where we got our temperature from. So that means if I sketch Euclidean Schwarzschild, I get this sort of picture. Because at large R, this factor tends to 1. So I've just got a periodic time. So that's my tau coordinate. And so it looks like a cylinder at large R. As I go down to R equals 2 gm, my space looks locally like R squared, little patch of R squared in the vicinity of the origin. So what that means is I've taken the cylinder, it's a cylinder at large r, it's a little patch of flat space at small r, you've got to interpolate between the two, and if I look at the size of tau circles, it's 1 minus 2 gm on r. So the size of my tau circle is 1, and then it starts to shrink, and eventually goes to 0. So this is my geometry of the r tau section of my black hole. So topologically, that's R squared. And then, of course, I've got the two spheres sitting on top. So that's my Euclidean Schwarzschild. So where would I get a boundary? Well, let me think about evaluating this action, and I'm going to just use a cutoff. I'm going to say, okay, let me evaluate the action. What I'm going to do is evaluate it in a finite region up to some very large radius r. And then I'm going to just see what happens, okay? So I'm looking at a finite patch of my Schwarzschild solution out to a radius r, and then I'm going to let that radius go to infinity. So that's how I'm going to calculate this boundary term. Oops. Okay, so on that surface, this is my surface delta m. So on that surface, I've got a three-dimensional metric. It's a two-sphere of radius capital R, and then it's a single S1, but tau here has periodicity 8 pi gm, and it's multiplied by this fixed prefactor. So that's my surface, and then my, if I sketch my inward-pointing normal, n,
I'm a little bit confused as constructing this path integral. I don't know where the manifold is, right? I mean, the only thing that I can do is solve Einstein equations that gives me a metric but doesn't identify which manifold I am.
No, so the notion, I mean, there's a lot that's sort of not entirely well defined here, but the notion is that you're looking at various just classical solutions that in this case have a certain set, you know, certain set of properties. So the one I want to focus in on here is a particular periodicity, because I want to look at classes of solutions which all have the same periodicity of Euclidean time. So it, in terms, I'm just identifying one here, the Schwarzschild solution. There could be many. In fact, I can construct loads of different solutions which are asymptote this general behavior, even just without thinking about, you know, anything to do with rotation. So if I start to add fields onto my space-time, I can add, you know, I can have a different solution in the interior, but still have the same overall temperature. So I'm really using this more as a, you know, I sort of mentioned that there's a sort of sense in which you have to just kind of, you know, go along, sort of buy into it to some extent. But, you know, the manifold itself is what you're integrating over when you get this Euclidean action. So if you can go off and find, you know, say, 10 solutions that all have this same property, you would have to add them all in. And so, of course, if you find 10, chances are you find infinitely many.
So, well, I mean, because here you have the integral over the boundary of the manifold, mm-hmm. but I can have many manifolds with the same boundary. And
so as long as your manifold has this same asymptotic property, which, in so I'm not saying that the manifold, in this case, that the manifold has to have the same boundary. At the moment, I'm just looking at a classical solution, Schwarzschild, and I'm integrating, I'm trying to compute that Euclidean action. And what I'm interested in is just this particular periodicity beta. And as I say, if you can get other solutions that still have this periodicity beta, then you've extended the classical solutions you're summing over. I'm, at the moment, I'm sort of trying to keep this as clean as possible. I'm just looking at Einstein vacuum gravity, and I'm looking at the Schwarzschild solution here to try and get an expression to evaluate the Euclidean action, and then to sort of to say, well, you know, this works. It gives the right entropy. But it is true that is a very simplistic thing to do, and it's very restrictive because I'm only looking within vacuum solutions. So I can, if I add extra fields in, I have extra solutions I have to sum over. So, you know, for example, you can find solutions which have asymptotically the same periodicity, but have sort of near the event horizon, have, you know, are shifted. So they have things like virtual world, sort of string world sheets around your event horizon, and that will change the details of the computation of the partition function, which also then changes the thermodynamic properties of the black hole. So I'm really talking about pure Einstein gravity here. So, but all I need within pure Einstein gravity is this property. I don't know if that helps. Okay, so what I need to have is the extrinsic curvature K, which is the divergence of this normal. So that's given by my four-dimensional expression. And so if I compute that for my normal, I get that answer. So that's my extrinsic curvature. And so if I integrate k root h, over my boundary manifold, my delta m, well, my extrinsic curvature doesn't depend on any of those internal coordinates, tau, theta, or phi. So that they just give me an overall factor of 4 pi beta. And so I just get k root h. And of course, root h is just r squared times the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r. So if I work that out, I find that the integral of the extrinsic curvature over that large two-sphere is to leading order proportional to r squared. So if I try and set capital R to infinity, my action's going to blow up. So it looks like I'm in trouble. I've gone from zero to infinity. So that's not really what I wanted. I didn't want to go from zero to infinity. I wanted to go from zero to some finite number. However, if I imagine, if I look at that first term, it's minus 8 pi beta r squared. There's no m in there, at least the only implicit m is in beta. So that, it looks like that action would diverge anyway if I was computing an action for flat space. So let me look again. So I need to construct a flat space result that, so I'm looking at flat space with a periodic Euclidean time, so that's flat space at finite temperature, and I have to match it to that cigar, the same geometry. So what that means is if I want to take a Euclidean time with the same periodicity, then Then in order to match on, if I want to compare like with like, I have to match at large R to the same manifold. So I have to introduce the same constant factor of 1 minus 2 gm on R. So my extrinsic curvature now for flat space is just 2 over R. And here my N is minus D by DR, because it's just flat space. And so I see that the integral of K0 root H, sorry, it's minus 2 over R. So I get the same factor 4 pi beta coming from the integral over tau, theta, and phi. That's my square root of boundary metric. And then my k is just 2 over r with the minus sign. Just realized accuracy police have been asleep. This should just be 2r here. R squared times 2 over R should just be 2R. So if I to use the fact that R is large relative to GM, then I can expand this square root. So the square root of 1 minus 2 GM on R is just 1 minus GM on R. And so I see my flat space answer is also infinite, and infinite to the same degree as what I got for the Schwarzschild answer. So that divergent term is not really physical, it's just something that's there. It's there even in flat space where we would expect to have a zero result. So what I'm going to do is I'm simply going to subtract this infinity off from my Gibbons-Hawking boundary term by saying that the renormalized value of the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term is simply the bare value subtracting off the sort of flat space result.
Join these two manifolds so that I have a manifold without boundary, which is the thing that you want at the end. Doesn't that subtract like in a good way? I mean, it sounds like for example in field theory when you have an infinity and you just want to cut the infinity, like adding a counter term. Why is it valid in here?
Well, it's notionally the same thing because you're sort of trying to subtract off the vacuum value of your action. So notionally, I'm doing exactly the same thing here. I'm saying my overall sort of minimal solution is Minkowski space-time. And so if that action is infinite, then I subtract that from any of my other answers to get a finite, hopefully to get a finite result. So, I mean, in terms of the methodology, it's exactly the same methodology that you're applying. you're sort of evaluating this action, which is sort of analogous to, you know, I've sort of said it's roughly analogous to this Hamiltonian or energy. It's not really an energy, but and you're getting an infinite answer, and that's sort of making you think, okay, let me just check that I don't get an infinity for my vacuum, which is Minkowski space-time. And then I calculate that, and I see that I do, and so I subtract the two to get a finite result. That's the problem. I'm using vacuum in two senses. So when we say vacuum in the context of gravity, we're imagining an empty solution, and that's that. You know, that can be curved, right? Whereas, you know, here I'm imagining a vacuum as being, the ground state of my theory. So I've used it in two. You know, that's why I was sort of hedging a bit when I was saying vacuum. So a ground state, let me use that word instead. So I would expect in gravity that Minkowski space-time was my ground state somehow.
But however, I mean, if I take the action, I vary the action, I have the, basically, in this sense, varying the action is finding the minimum, right? Or the ground state as well.
Varying in action will give you localized minima,
right,
so to speak.
Equivalent to Einstein solutions, mm-hmm. And Schwarzschild is also a vacuum solution. Right?
Sorry, what are also?
Schwarzschild is a vacuum solution.
Yeah.
So what I'm
in the sense of no matter. Mm-hmm.
So in this case, I don't know, why are we just subtracting the part of the Minkowski metric, not the Schwarzschild solution, if it's also a ground state for this particular...
No, but I'm imagining... So there's always... So there could be, and indeed there are, you know, a set different localized minima, each of which, you know, is a legitimate solution because it's some in some localized minimum and possibly even disconnected from other localized minima. But notionally, I would like to think that flat space is my absolute ground state, because if I have a black hole, I had to have formed it at some point, and therefore I had matter present. So a Schwarzschild black hole has a positive mass if I measure it in an appropriate sense out asymptotically far away, so near spatial infinity. And so I would imagine somehow I would expect, just intuitively, that black hole is therefore of some sort of higher energy, even though it isn't, because this is the trouble. We use words that don't really have, you know, this same rigorous definition in gravity. But you know, I've had something to have formed the black hole in the first place. So that's really where I'm coming from here, that somehow the Minkowski vacuum really should be, you know, in the sort of absolute zero gravitationally. But of course, there's no formal. And then you just get even worse because you realize you can make your action arbitrarily negative. So, so if I subtract these two answers, I get 1 over 8 pi g . So I look at the difference between my straight Schwarzschild, bare Schwarzschild answer, my bare flat space answer, and I've got a minus gm inside that bracket, and so overall I get the result that my renormalized action is beta m on 2. So let's just see if that sort of all fits together. Let's just look at an entropy of Schwarzschild black holes within the class of Schwarzschild black holes. So here, this gives me M on 2. So the entropy is given in terms of a derivative of the partition function, and so my entropy should be beta squared dm by d beta, according to this type of argument. But my mass is just beta over 8 pi g, so this is beta squared on 8 pi g. And so if I convert that back into masses, I think I should have a factor of 2 there. I see that my entropy is proportional to mass squared, and if I kind of try and pull things together and look at expressing it in terms of the area, I see indeed that my entropy is a quarter of the area with a factor of g in there. So I've got, via this rather circuitous route, I've actually shown that the entropy is this A over 4G, at least for Schwarzschild black holes. So this then leads us actually into a sort of quite an interesting set of questions once we try and put black holes and thermodynamics together. So we have the question of S should be a sort of log of microstates. But classically, black holes have very few charges. So that's one puzzling thing. And so one of the interesting things about string theory is it's actually provided a resolution to this question or this issue, at least in certain limits, certain black holes. You can actually start to identify microstates corresponding to the black hole, and you can start to actually address this question. So I don't know whether that'll be discussed in the string theory course, but it's certainly, you know, one of the nicer results. At least from the perspective of gravity, coming out of string theory, the fact that there is at least some partial addressing of this problem. And then, of course, we have the fact that the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass, and so black holes have negative specific heat. Which is yet another sort of reason to have held our breath through this Euclidean argument, because typically when you talk about field theory at finite temperature, you're imagining yourself in an equilibrium state. And what we're saying here is if a black hole has negative specific heat, it evaporates a little, it loses mass, it gets hotter, it loses more mass, et cetera, et cetera. So that doesn't sound particularly an equilibrium state at all. So we can look at our rate of change of the mass, which is going to be proportional to t to the fourth times the area of the black hole. So that's area is proportional to m squared. Temperature is proportional to inverse mass. And so we see that our m dot is proportional to 1 over m squared. So our lifetime of a black hole is proportional to the cube of its mass.
The m dot is the derivative of time with respect to
time.
Time?
So it's a black body radiation. And so, you know, so this is your typical black body law, and then you multiply by the area. So I'm just doing orders of magnitude here. I'm just looking at, you know, what sort of things are happening. And so the notion is that if you just had a black hole and nothing else, that it would disappear after a lifetime of order m cubed. So I guess it's sort of some numbers. Hope this is dimensionally correct. So what does this have to say? Well, if we, again, I use this, I said earlier on, a real black hole will form from gravitational collapse. So what that means is, if I draw a Penrose diagram of my black hole, this is the sort of picture I get. I've got to the past, I've got Minkowski spacetime plus some matter distribution, where the matter collapses in on itself and forms a black hole. So in the future, I have, this is a patch of the Schwarzschild-Penrose diagram. So I've got an event horizon. Scrime plus and a singularity. And so I'm kind of just piecing together the different parts of the Penrose diagrams to construct a causal picture of my realistic black hole. So you might sometimes see the cartoon picture where this is my horizon here, and I formed it from some sort of gravitational collapse, but this is in no sense a causal picture, it's just a cartoon of what happens. The matter is scrunching in, and eventually an event horizon forms. It sort of starts at the origin and grows out. And the event horizon is simply the boundary between light rays that make it to infinity and those that don't. So at some point before the singularity forms, most likely, at r equals zero, an outgoing null geodesic will not make it out. So it'll kind of be pulled back in on itself and back to the singularity. But then, what happens if the black hole evaporates? So again, causal picture. We've got a horizon, the black hole has formed, but then it disappears. That means I've got to have something that looks again like Minkowski spacetime. And so this is my causal picture of a black hole that has formed and then evaporated. So here you see again to the future that looks like the Penrose diagram for Minkowski space or perturbed Minkowski space. To the past it does, but in the middle, we formed an event horizon, and then it's evaporated. So this is our picture of an evaporating black hole. So what's happened, though, is that we've still got this horizon and we've still got this region of space that we cannot access from infinity. And so this leads to a loss of information. And this bothers at least some sector of the community because, strictly speaking, it leads to a loss of unitarity. One could imagine forming a pure state that somehow will collapse, form a black hole, the black hole radiates thermally, and then there's no black hole, but you've gone from a pure state to a mixed state, so you've lost unitarity. So that's why this is still one of those areas of where gravity and quantum field theory come together, where we still don't have a sort of final answer about have we lost information, have we lost unitarity, or does something come into play? Is there some means by which unitarity can be recovered? So this is still one of these open questions. Right. I can leave it up to you as to which side of the debate you come down on. You probably have good company either way. Okay.